Welcome to the Florida Real Estate and Entrepreneur Podcast, where we interview the best and the brightest business and real estate leaders. Our mission is to inspire and help 1,000 entrepreneurs to start and succeed in real estate and entrepreneurship. We will give you the exact playbook to succeed in your business through the experience of those who blaze the path. We're bringing the what's working today directly to you. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Florida Real Estate and Entrepreneur Podcast. Today, I've got with me Ryan Whitefield, a friend of mine and longtime real estate investor. He's been in development, building houses, has built hundreds of houses, done massive construction projects, hails from the UK. Ryan, why don't you give people maybe the 2-minute overview on you and your business and how you kind of got to where you are today?
Yeah, I grew up in England, single mom, 3 boys on welfare. She instilled work ethic into us boys, you know, always working hard to provide for us. We saw how hard she worked and I wanted to kind of follow in those footsteps. I did all right at school, but I was more interested in sports and the actual kind of academics. But being so into my sport, it led me to being in the first, we call it football academy. You guys, obviously soccer academy in England. So that was great experience for me. But my dream of being a professional football player didn't obviously happen. But I ended up working in construction at like 17, I think it was. So
you might be tall enough to play sports.
Yeah, I'm definitely tall enough. Yeah, so 17, I was working in construction. And then that gave me the ability to buy my first house at the age of 18. So got into the real estate game quite early, which was obviously good. But in my early 20s, I wasn't the best with money. You know, I made some money mistakes and, you know, learned some early lessons in business. I had my own drywall company early, and that was quite difficult. But then, obviously, when the recession came, 2008, I think that was, like most people in construction and real estate, we kind of struggled a little bit. I used to work for a lot of national house builders and other, you know, private custom home builders, and they were literally just going bankrupt overnight, owing us a lot of money. So I went through it 2008, 2009. It was difficult, but you know, I did get through it, barely survived. My wife is from America and she had been living in England for 6 years. And we always said we'd raise our kids in the US. So that was time for us to, okay, we've got out of this, you know, barely. We still had some assets in England, but we couldn't sell them because of the recession. So I moved to America with barely $6,000 in our pocket. I had to move in with my in-laws in a very small town in Minnesota. So that was difficult for me too. But, you know, we got there. And then it was like, okay, now we got to find the next chapter. What are we doing? And even in England, I'd been into real estate, you know, buying some things and flipping them along the way. And that was what I really wanted to do in America. And by the time I'd moved to America, it was 2011, I believe. So you could still buy houses pretty cheap. So as I started exploring the Twin Cities, the Minneapolis markets, there were pretty good pockets where you could still buy homes for $40,000, $50,000 for 4-bed, 3-bathroom homes. So, you know, I'm like, man, there's a market here because the rents were $1,500 to $1,800. You know, Section 8 even were paying very well. And I'm like, there's a market here, but I've got no money left. What do I do? So I, you know, went and made my first pitch deck, my first ever presentation. Wasn't pretty. Went back to some people in England. Hey, we can do this in America. Are you interested? Are you interested? And people took a chance with me. And it kind of snowballed a little bit. And then there was a contact from somebody I had in Singapore. And then suddenly I ended up with several Singaporean investors. And it was great because I was amassing this rental portfolio with other people's money. And at that time, I couldn't leverage. I couldn't leverage any banks. I didn't have any credit. So I had to buy the whole house in kind of cash. And I was giving my investors a 12% return at the time on their money. But we were netting 16, 17, 18% on the rent. So I was making a little bit on the rents. Where it really benefited us was we owned all the equity. So fast forward 5 years down from doing that, I was able to sell all of the assets to one big hedge fund. And that changed where I could go forward with my business. And that was when I really started opening up to fix and flips and new builds. And, you know, that was the start for me.
Yeah, I mean, you have probably one of the most incredible stories out of everybody I know. You came over here from the UK. Obviously, your wife's from here, so you knew some people. It's not like you came here not knowing anybody. But it's so many investors already think it's impossible to buy a house with no money. And how could I ever do that? I really want to, and I don't. And your story is so good because it just proves all of them wrong. So at this time, you get this portfolio in Minnesota, and you're obviously, I mean, your timing couldn't be better. 2011, mm-hmm. Now you're hitting just like good year after good year. At what point did you migrate your business down to Florida? Because you guys now do these high-end luxury flips and new builds and all this beautiful stuff, St. Pete up to Clearwater, all through Tampa.
Yeah, I think I've fixed and flipped over 500 houses now, and we have over 500 doors rental portfolio through multifamilies. So it's definitely progressed over the years rapidly. But I'd say about 6 years ago, Minnesota started to get very tough. It was a tough market. Every home you'd go to, it would always be the same faces at auctions, or it'd be the same people bidding on the same properties, and expenses were getting very high. You know, people looking for $30 an hour to push a broom. And it was getting more and more difficult. I think I had 3 or 4 properties in a row we flipped, and we didn't make any money on them. I think one we lost and several we barely broke even on. So it's like, okay, how are we going to diversify here? What are we looking at doing? Maybe this is the wrong market for us with Minnesota and the weather. You know, you have 5 months of, even though this year they haven't had any, but typically they get 5 months of pretty bad weather. And the buyers, you know, they're out there, but very limited. They don't want to buy homes with snow on the roof that they can't see, landscaping, they have no idea what it looks like. So I started to explore other markets, and my wife had family in Tampa. So I went and did my first flip in Tampa, out of state. You know, I had to come here, find contractors, build new relationships. And so there was a lot of to and fro in. And the first house I did, I made $40,000 on. So it was like, okay, that was pretty good. See if we can do it again. And we did. And then we made more on the next one. And then it just snowballed. Now we have 3. And then suddenly we have 10. And, you know, it's putting procedures and operations in place. But it took a lot of big commitment from me and from my wife also, because at that time we just had a baby. He was now 6, my youngest. So, you know, sometimes I get a call from a wholesaler or one of my realtors that I network with at 10 o'clock at night and say, hey, I've got this deal. Literally, it's exactly what you buy, but you've got to come down tomorrow. So I'd be booking a flight at, you know, 10 o'clock at night to leave at 5 a.m. And sometimes I'd fly out and I'd come back the same evening. Sometimes wow. I'd fly out, you know, 5 a.m. I'd run around all of my properties, you know, and come back the same night, sometimes the next day. So it was a big commitment for me and my wife. And it was tough because sometimes it'd be every week. Sometimes it'd be every 2 weeks. And it got to a point where I wasn't doing anything in Minnesota anymore. So it was
yeah.
tough.
And then you guys moved base camp over here to the Tampa area because now your whole operation's moving.
Exactly.
Here.
My wife's a Minnesota girl, loves her Four Seasons. So that was tough, but she really enjoys being here now. We get to go home back to Minnesota and get our snow fix, you know.
Yeah, for a couple days and then come back to the nice warm weather.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We love Florida. There's so much opportunity here to, you know, it's such a big market.
Yeah.
So many suburbs.
Ryan, what was it that you saw? Like, obviously you had family here and you had some familiarity with the market, but what was it that you saw in Central Florida? Like, what was the opportunity here? Did you notice that it was growing? Did you see development at this time? Because this is, I mean, if you're down in Tampa today, you see development everywhere, like every big, huge new buildings. What did you see at that time that let you know, hey, this is a significantly growing market, which it was at that time?
So initially, when I first started, it was kind of a gamble, right? It was more take a chance on Florida. But obviously, we did some market research on demographics. And I think the statistic now is 10,000 people a day move to Florida. I think that's the average, has been for the last 3 or 4 years. When I first looked at it, it was like 3,000. So there was still a good influx of people coming into Florida, even when I was there, as areas like Minnesota, where I was before, yeah, you get a bit, but you also get a lot of people leaving too. So it kind of, the balance stays the same. So that was kind of what I was looking at for volume and people coming. And then I got lucky as well, because obviously during the COVID pandemic,
just about to ask that,
it just skyrocketed. It went crazy. And then whilst all the people were coming, all the, you know, the big Fortune 500 companies started relocating here as well and bringing, you know, new offices. So they bought, additional jobs and everything. So it's not just, people say it's only elderly people that move to Florida. It's totally not. You know, of course, we still have a large population of elderly, but people coming here to retire, but it's becoming a young, hip, trendy market where people want to be. And the Fortune 500 companies, which are employing in those demographics, expanding in a big way here.
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating. I was definitely going to ask the COVID question because your timing could not be more impeccable. Get in the States and start flipping in 2011 as the market goes on a historic run, beautiful. Obviously, you get a great rental portfolio in the Midwest. And then you hit Florida right before COVID when Florida has the most appreciation across the country we've seen in quite some time. Yeah. And you're doing big flips, you're creating big margins. That's really incredible. And I think you're right too, because a lot of people think this is where the snowbirds come. I think there's still a large part of that that's truth, but with there's some tech companies that have moved to Florida, down in Miami and Central Florida. You've got finance moving down here, Goldman Sachs, all kinds of big institutions like that, and bringing jobs with it. It's bringing all these young people, but the pricing in the market is so high. I'm really interested on where you see it going, because you can't get into a starter home for really under $400,000.
Yeah.
Today. So where do you see the market going? Is it new builds, build to rent? Who are we competing with out there as investors?
Yeah. One of the things I didn't mention just now is I love about Florida as well. It is very diverse, right? So there are entry-level homes, albeit they've gone up and they're expensive, but there's, you know, the mid-range, there's blue collar, there's luxury, you know. As in Minneapolis, I didn't have as many opportunities. Yes, there's wealthier, affluent areas. But in Florida, you've got beach, you've got water, you've got downtowns, old towns, and then you've got the suburbs. And here, especially, I think Tampa and St. Pete, which are the main markets I'm in, have become so expensive. There's still bidding wars. Things are still selling, you know, within a few days with multiple offers. It's still happened. There's still not enough homes to service what's needed. And obviously, people are trying to wait and hold off a little bit for rate drops. But I think what I'm seeing is people are moving to the next ring, to the next ring. And that's what's happening. I live in Wesley Chapel, which is just north of Tampa. And it's one of the biggest, fastest growing suburbs in this Tampa Bay area. And they're already building beyond me now and to the next markets beyond to make more affordable living. More affordable homes.
Yeah. And this is really, because I bought about 15 minutes from you. I bought my house over in the Bexley community. And you're right, is Tampa's like a combustion engine. It's like, you know, it can only hold so much. So then you saw massive developments start to creep north and creep over to the east. And you've seen now kind of, you know, Tampa's in Hillsborough County, and we've seen Pasco County. The amount of development that's happening along the 54 and the 56, mm-hmm. the infrastructure they're putting in there, the shopping, the restaurants is very Tampa-like. It's wild. Everything that is land out there is almost all spoken for by big developers. 300-400 units going up left and right everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are. And one of the issues is, like you say, infrastructure. You know, they need to get more public transport going. They need to start putting bus lanes on the freeways, you know, because the commute into town from these outer suburbs is difficult. So there's things like that. But these suburbs, like in Wesley Chapel where I am, we have everything that we ever need. You know, I don't necessarily need to leave here apart to go and visit properties. And that's the way they're building all the suburbs here. So obviously you're going to have people that need to commute into downtown and into the city areas to work, but it's booming. And in regards to your question about the competition, who is our competition? I think there's 3,000 apartments going up within a 1 mile radius of where I'm at. And this is all across, you know, Tampa Bay and Florida, really, in general, to service that market that can't afford to buy homes because of either the interest rates or because of the low inventory. It's kind of a catch-22, because what's going to happen is the rates are going to drop. Everyone's going to go on a buying frenzy again. And then prices are going to keep creeping up, or we're going to be in the multiple offer situation again, because there's still not enough inventory for what is needed, you know? And
yeah.
That's a genuine problem.
I think we're seeing a couple of things here. We are seeing a large quantity of apartments come online in 2024. These are new build apartments. So we're seeing apartment inventory come online, particularly in the major MSAs across the country like Tampa, because they're great, strong markets. So we're starting to see developers who are starting to get into their plans and start to lay their foundation and build these big apartment buildings, because the way that they have to support the population is through rentals. Like people, it's going to become more and more of a renter nation because people are priced out of houses. It's exponential. Like something like 30 million people, the difference between a 4% interest rate and a 7 or 8% interest rate is like 30 million people who can afford a $400,000 house. And there's only 360 million people in the United States. So we're looking at 10% of the population gets priced out, which is significant at that scale. I'm also seeing, Ryan, I don't know what you're seeing or what you've looked at, but I see a lot of those institutions who came down, like the Black Rocks, they came down and they bought up a bunch of single family inventory in 21 and 22. I saw them pivot in 22 to a lot more build to rent models. So like townhouses and even some like single families. Are you seeing that as well?
I am definitely seeing that. There's three developments within a mile of me. And I think that's a great service to people, to be honest with you. Before, planning and zoning wouldn't typically allow you to build a whole community and you can rent out the whole site. You know, if it's houses, it would typically only, you'd only be able to do that in apartments. But we're seeing several of these facilities come up, and it's great because it services a need for people needed, not just an apartment. They need a house. And, you know, they're able to offer great amenities on some of these properties.
Yeah. And there's a need for that. They're obviously looking at the economics of this, but they're also looking at the demographics, because we've got a large population of older millennials. So those in their mid to upper 30s who are having families, and maybe the downtown apartment life or the apartment life isn't the best fit. So you see them building these townhouses and these houses. It's really brilliant on the institutional part to build the rent stuff. So, I mean, if your timing was impeccable, 2011, buying these houses for $40,000, goodness, I bet your regret is I wish I bought more at this point. But
yeah, but you know, everything's in hindsight. I got quite an education. The first house I ever bought in Minnesota, I did without permits, because in England, we don't have a permit system. So I fixed and flipped this whole house, and I had a knock at the door, and it was a building official. And he's like, "You've done a great job of the house, but where's your permits?" And I'm like, "What do you mean permits?" And also, this is a category 2 condemned house, so you have to bring it up to New Day Code. So I ended up having to rehab that house twice.
Oh, no.
But I became an expert in category 2 condemned properties that people didn't want. And I became on first name terms with the people in that department, and I was a go-to person for it. So I created a niche, you know, out of what was going on. And it's kind of what I did with the pivot, you know, with the low inventory that's been going on in our market for probably a good 2 years now. I had to take a step back and say, okay, you're used to flipping 50 houses a year, running a big operation. What do we really want to do? Where are we actually successful at? And most of our success came from the high-end flips, you know, the buying for 800 to a million and selling for 1.5 to 2 million. Buying the homes in, you know, affluent neighborhoods that might be 1,000 square feet, scalping the roof off and going up, because you can add a second story for, say, 180 bucks a square foot in a neighborhood that's selling for 400 bucks a square foot. So it's finding the little niches of what you can do. And I couldn't have done all of this in Minnesota market. Tampa has allowed me to expand. So I'm in Clearwater Beach on the water, Clearwater Beach a block from the beach, St. Pete Beach on the water. There's so many, you know, high-end neighborhoods. And I'm still very picky with where I do these high-end homes. It's not just, oh, let's do one here. Because you have a lot of out-of-state buyers, you know, especially from New York, selling a $3 million apartment, and now suddenly they can have a house on the water a block from the beach with a boat dock. What? We can go from this to that. And there's a lot of cash buyers in our market too.
Yeah, even at that price, which is, I think the lesson for folks is, you hear this all the time, but the riches are in the niches. It's not even that you're niched out, but you have a particular set of skills. You've developed these skills, and you didn't develop them last week. Like, you've been doing this for over a decade, almost two decades, probably, between the UK and the US.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you learned how to, identify value. You learned how to do the construction. You're not scared to take a roof off of a house. Most newer flippers or even folks who've been doing it for a few years are, they want to do the carpet and paint jobs. They want to do the really simple stuff because the big construction and the uncertainty of the unknown makes them incredibly nervous. But you've got all this background in construction and skill that you've developed over the years. You're like, oh, I'll just take the top off and build it for 180 a square foot and I can sell it at 400 a square foot. I think there's a lot of your skills have allowed you to do that, where I think people are just...
Yeah, and that's progressive skills, right? That's progressive over time. I've learned a lot of costly and painful mistakes over the years. Sometimes it's been volume that saved my butt. You know, I've lost $80,000 on a house, you know, but I've made 100 plus on the next two. So it just varies, you know, with again, what you're learning and what you do with that knowledge that you've got, you know, and it just puts you in a different position. Like, for instance, two of our high-end flips were finished just before Christmas. I don't want to list a house right before Christmas. I want to wait for the spring market. But again, they're so profitable, I was able to refinance $700,000 out of those two houses and leave them to sit to the spring market. Then I'll list them in spring, and I've got another $700,000 in profit sitting in them, just because they're high end and we've made a lot of equity into them. It just gives me more freedom to do stuff, as I wouldn't have been able to do that if it would have been over, say, 10 additional properties. It would have been very difficult to refinance 10 properties and so on. So
yeah, and with a property like that, Ryan, do you, while you're holding it, do you rent it out? Do you Airbnb it, or do you just kind of hold on to it? Or
no, we just hold on to them. We just hold on to them. We got one which is in Old Northeast St. Pete, which is a $2 million home, which has an apartment out the back too. And we've been tempted to at least rent out the apartment out the back, but we just decided to wait. And now we're close to relisting several of our properties.
Ready to go to market at the hot part. Yeah. So as you're so intimately familiar, I'm really curious where you see the Florida real estate market going over the next year. We've got this uncertainty with rates. We still have a lot of people moving here. What do you think is going to happen in Florida? It seemed to cool down just a little bit, at least.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a big transition into rentals still, because people can't get onto the property ladder. And even those that can, we're going to end up into a bidding frenzy again. Like I said, as soon as the rates start to drop, I've spoken to so many people that have buyers, they're just waiting for that rate drop, and then they're ready to pull the trigger. And we've all heard that saying, you know, date the rate and marry the house. But now is a truer time, because there's too many people sitting on the fence over 0.5% interest. If those people wait too long, what's going to happen is everybody is going to get off the fence at the same time, and then it's just going to be a bidding war, multiple offers, and they're going to struggle to find a home that they want again. So I encourage people to actually buy now. And just think about a refinance later. It's the only way you're going to get something that you want to be in right now.
Yeah, and you can get a 2-1 or 3-1 rate buy down, where you can buy your interest rate down for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's an economic backing to that, what you're saying. And that's the fact that there's low inventory throughout the United States. We actually have not caught up from building from the 2008 crash. So we're short in the United States somewhere between 2 and 4 million houses, and the builders aren't really catching up. Here's the other unique thing, and you know this as a developer and builder yourself, is there's way more margin building a 2,500 to 4,000 square foot house than there is building a 12 to 1500 square foot house, which would be considered affordable, 12, 1500 square foot. So the builders aren't going to, even when they are building inventory to catch up, which it's going to take them a long time, they're not going to be building the 12, 1500 square foot house. They're going to be building the 3000 square foot houses that are going to be selling a million plus.
Yeah, they are. Even if the government bring out a program to incentivize builders to do more affordable homes, then you've got, you know, the labor issues that come
expensive.
Too. Labor got really expensive here the last couple of years. Obviously, materials went up for everybody, and they've started to creep back down to normal levels. But labor is tough. You know where I live. You know, my builder here is a higher end builder, and they've been taking 2 years to build houses, and it's crazy. So that's another thing that's happening. But again, people are coming in from additional states. They need somewhere to live. So it's that catch 22 where Florida is a big market. There's a lot going on, and you just got to be able to cherry pick and network with the right people to get on the best deals, you know, and the right areas.
Yeah. Nothing changes. It's been the same age old. Location matters in real estate. Getting in the deal at a good price, buying a good deal still matters no matter where you are, what you're doing, whether you're building new and buying an infill lot or you're buying a flip from a wholesaler. It doesn't really matter. You get it at the right price, you'll probably be okay. You get it in a good location, you'll probably be okay.
Yeah. And that's where networking is important too. So over the years, obviously with the volume we've done, I've contemplated opening a wholesale division to my company multiple times, but it's a whole nother business. You know, you guys have to specialize in that and really dial in and focus on what you're doing and be good at what you do. When you diversify, sometimes you can lose focus on one business or the other. And I don't begrudge wholesalers making what they make. They spend a lot of money on marketing times when they don't get anything back in return. So, yeah. You know, I prefer to focus my time on networking with fellow wholesalers, fellow realtors, you know, where I am the first phone call when they have a deal that meets my parameters. So, yeah, the network. So
if you're a wholesaler and you're listening to this and you've got something near the water in St. Peter Clearwater, make sure you give Ryan a call first. He'll buy it.
Yes, please.
That's awesome. Yeah. Hey, what, Ryan, for as we get to the last couple of questions here.
Yeah.
You've got so much experience. You've been in the Midwest. You've been in the Florida market for a while now. What's the most important lesson you've learned in business? Not just real estate, but in business? Because you run a whole team. You run a company. You guys are doing multifamily, buying apartments. You're doing new builds. Like what's the most important lesson you've learned doing that?
So there's a couple of things. So bear with me here. So the first one is, some people might have heard me say this before, but I always say being a business owner is a lonely place. It can be a lonely place. I don't want to, my wife works in our business. She's an interior architect, best designer in the business, but I don't burden her with what's going on with business aspects. You know, so when you're the boss of a business and you've got nowhere to turn to, it can be tough. It can be lonely. And I joined my first mastermind, which you're obviously part of as well, Adam, seven figure flipping going nearly 5 years ago. And it was when I joined a mastermind that I realized there's so many people out there just the same as me. They're trying to figure everything out by themselves. They don't know who to go to or who to ask. They feel embarrassed to ask competition, you know. And once you join a mastermind, you realize, man, there's hundreds of people in the same situation. Suddenly you're bouncing ideas off of somebody. Someone's coming to me and sharing a problem that they've got. Well, guess what? I've just been through that. Do this. So you end up helping each other. And that was huge for my business in growth. And I'm in several masterminds today. I've even got my kid in a mastermind because I believe in them greatly, you know, for education. The second thing with business was taking too long to hire the right people in the right seats. For the longest time, I tried to wear too many hats. When I was in Minnesota, I was the project manager. I was the superintendent. I was the acquisitions guy. I was dealing with sales. Making all the decisions and then saying to my wife, okay, here's this. Can you go and, you know, do the designs, do the floor plans? It was just, I took too long to hire the right people. And I could have accelerated my business much earlier if I'd have realized it's not a one-man show. As I stated, I'm in multifamily, same thing. If I hadn't have realized that it's a team sport and you need a team to do these things, I wouldn't be where I'm at with over 500 doors right now. I'd probably still be scratching around, you know, 50 to 100 mark, because you push each other. The last thing is, I'm an action taker. And I know that sounds cheesy, but if you don't take action, you're not going to go anywhere. You know, sometimes it's taking action and sticking your foot into the unknown forces you to figure stuff out. And an example of that was, you know, I had, you know, a 6 unit and a 10 unit and an 8 unit apartment buildings. And then my next step up was to a 40 unit in Gainesville. And it was like, I submitted my offer and crap, it got accepted. It's like, now what? You know, if I'd have waited and waited and waited till I was comfortable, I never would have got through that process, but I did. I had to find investors. I had to work with banks. I had to get everything structured. I had to get it taken down. I had to put a business plan in place for it. And I was forced to do that. And because I did it on that, then you realize, well, this is no different to doing 100 unit. So then I bought 100 unit like a couple of months later, and then a 200 unit, you know, and it just makes things easier. Once you take action, that's where you get your education.
Yeah, I think that's, well, a couple of things that, you know, you and I are part of the seven-figure flipping family mastermind. You talked about it. But what's really special about that, I mean, all the masterminds are good. They all have good information. What's really special about that is the amount of abundance that we have in our kind of our network of investors and business owners. There's not a guy or gal in our kind of world that you and I are in that you couldn't call and say, hey, I have this thing, or do you have a recommendation for this, where they wouldn't cut out 5 minutes, 10 minutes of their day to give you what you need. I mean, I've seen you personally help even some of our baby investors in the community, especially those in Florida. Like, I see you pouring into them, knowing that, you know, it's, we don't operate from scarcity, which I think is really undervalued, because there's so many deals out there. There's so many ways to invest out there. And it's good karma, and it comes back to you, because everybody knows when they have something in your niche or something that you are interested in, maybe they find an apartment, they're going to come to you. And you've poured into so many people that you've kind of fed into this community of abundance we have. It's so incredible. And my kids also in the Teenage Tycoon Mastermind learning this kind of stuff too. It's so powerful.
Yeah, it's the circle of life, right? So many people have helped me along the way. I love being able to help people back. And then too many people see somebody doing the same thing on their doorstep as competition. You know, it shouldn't be like that. A typical example is me and Jesse Trulio were the big hitters in seven-figure altitude, you know, mastermind. And he calls me up one day and says, hey, I'm coming to your turf. Can we meet for lunch? Because I'm opening operations in Tampa. Did I panic? No. I brought him in. I opened my doors. I gave him all my, you know, people. My brother still, you know, helps them project manage today. So what's mine is yours. Me and Jesse went on from that, and we own over 400 doors together now, multifamily. We'd never done business before. But just from me being, you know, open and not seeing it as competition, but to help each other, suddenly those conversations lead somewhere else.
Opportunities.
And then you become business partners. And,
it's,
and now we're, you know, we're great friends too. So it's always be open to other people.
It's super powerful. I think that's, I feel like that's one of the first hurdle, especially newer investors have to get over, of this scarcity mindset. They're so concerned about, you know, a deal or two. Like, deals come and go. And you've learned that hundreds and if not a thousand deals over your career, like, they come and go. They're abundant. Yeah. Relationships, though, are something you can have forever, which is why I know. And I think that part of that is the reason why you've been successful making the jump to commercial multifamily, because you have investors and you've built such good relationships and you have such good operations that people know, like, and trust you. And that, to me, I watch you and what you guys are doing, and your ability to take down the bigger commercial multifamily stuff is directly correlated to the relationships you've built over time. I guess maybe I'm leading you into that because that's my outside view of you. But what would you say your superpower is?
Superpower, definitely the action taker piece, but structures, processes, procedures. You know, I'm not saying that you have to get everything set before you move forward, but always be working on your new structures, your processes and procedures as you grow. You know, I'm big into diversification. So, you know, this year I'm diversifying heavily into residential assisted living. So right now, because I've been doing my single family stuff for so long, that's almost on autopilot with my structures and processes and procedures. So it frees me up to be looking at what I'm doing next. Multifamily, similar thing. But residential assisted livings is where I see a huge niche market this year. And that's where I'm going to be focusing a lot of my time, putting new structures, processes, and procedures in place. So we're a machine, you know, and we do it and do it well.
Yeah. And I think that also illuminates, like, you first, you have your business in order. You have your systems in place. You have your process in place. You have your people in place. And now you're growing another leg of your business into the residential assisted living, which is a great asset class. There's a lot of opportunity there if you can get into that industry and build the relationships that's required. But I know you will, obviously. You've proven that over and over. Man, that's awesome. I would ask you, I guess, to kind of wrap this up, you know, if people, for those folks who are going to listen to this in our Florida market, where do they find you? What are you looking for? What do you need right now?
Yeah. So to find me, www.revelogroup.com is our company. Revelo is my son's name backwards, Oliver. So if you forget Revelo, it's Oliver backwards. And what am I looking for? I'm always looking for the high-end homes. You know, we'll buy usually around 750 upwards is kind of what we're after. Affluent areas. Not scared of the small ones that might only be 1,100 square feet, because if there's a chance I can go up, then we would definitely look at it. So that's kind of our bread and butter. on the water, waterfront homes, things like that, and land as well. So I'm interested in land in, again, in similar areas for builds, or if there's a home that can be torn down and some new construction built, and also the residential assisted livings. So these are single family homes, large single family homes, not the big box stores. These are typically 6 to 16 bedrooms, 4,500 square feet up, that we do. It's protected by the Federal Fair Housing Act. These homes are in regular neighborhoods. They offer a more intimate setting to the big box stores. There's a silver tsunami coming, and we are making sure we're at the forefront and we're ready for what's going on.
Yeah, and you've proven your timing's impeccable to date. So if people have homes, St. Pete, Clearwater, 750,000, where they're seeing other nice new stuff sell for a couple million, they need to bring that to you. You'll pay cash for those things. And then when these folks are out who listen to this, go out and say, oh, well, I want to go find some properties for Ryan for residential assisted living. They're just looking for normal houses that have large square footage that you
large
can convert.
Large square footage in particular zoning. So if you're into that space and looking to be searching for things, reach out to me and we'll talk about our exact criteria. So there's different zoning matrices. You can do 6 bedrooms in any facility. It's protected by the Federal Fair Housing Act. Any neighborhood, you can do a 6-bedroom residential assisted living, but 6 is too small for our model of where we're at. So it's got to meet certain parameters.
Okay. Yeah. If you find bigger houses that you think might be a good fit, reach out to Ryan. His website is Oliver spelled backwards. So Revelo.
Yeah.
Revelo.com. And Ryan, man, I'm so grateful for you. I've learned so much from you over the years, and I appreciate you taking some time out of your day to meet with me and come on this podcast, man.
Appreciate you having me on.
Awesome, brother. Thanks so much.
Hopefully it helps somebody out there. So.
Definitely. Thanks, man.
Yeah.